Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This podcast is a joint presentation of the Colorado Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast.
Welcome everyone to Geriatric Journal Club here at closing in on the end of the summer already. Today we're excited. As we find antibiotic stewardship clashing sometimes with use of antibiotics that isn't mainstream or traditional, there's lots of questions. When to use what? And we've seen underuse, people appropriately that should be on antibiotics, the COPD. We're going to talk about that today. And we're going to start with Travis Neal, and then we'll move to Dr. Eric Ager.
Okay. Hi, everybody. So one of the reasons why I'm talking today is because for the last year I have helped out with a COPD study that was specific to post-acute care, and then I've also been doing a number of antibiotic reviews. And so I've got kind of a high-level summary of some take-home points that can be used tomorrow in your practice. And I am going to talk about procalcitonin and the use of eosinophil values vis-a-vis the two journal topics, but I'm not going to get into the journal articles in detail. And so I'm just going to give kind of a high level what I think are the take-home points of my experience over the last year, as well as those two articles. So let's jump right in. Procalcitonin, for those that don't know, is a serum biomarker that helps distinguish bacterial infection from other causes of infection or inflammation. So in clinical practice, the signs and symptoms of bacterial versus non-bacterial acute exacerbations, as we all know, overlap considerably. Very difficult to tell the two apart. So in patients with community-acquired pneumonia, procalcitonin is about 65 to 70% accurate in distinguishing bacterial from viral pathogens. When used as part of an algorithm in combination with clinical judgment in patients with lower respiratory tract infections, procalcitonin has been shown to reduce unnecessary antibiotic use by about 25 to 50% without increasing morbidity and mortality. However, so I was pretty excited about procalcitonin a while ago, and when the evidence started coming out showing how good it was at identifying bacterial infections. However, there are some definite limitations and some very recent information that was in a recent JAMA article pointing to the limitations of procalcitonin, where recent evidence point to that it's a test that's not available in all institutions, and because the usefulness of the assay is dependent on rapid turnaround time, testing should only be obtained at centers where results can be obtained in a timely manner. And then there's a growing amount of evidence pointing to false positives and false negatives, and specifically in patients with severe disease or severe infections. So procalcitonin-based therapy did not safely reduce antibiotic exposure because of prompt initiation of antibiotics in severely ill patients and patients that went to the ICU, because the evidence shows that the starting of routine antibiotics in this population improves 3-month survival regardless of the level of procalcitonin. The take-home message that I got from reading, you know, kind of a deep dive into the evidence was, I think procalcitonin can be a helpful measure, and specifically, you know, when in a patient that, you know, we have a patient, for example, that has a positive chest X-ray, so they have infiltrates or signs of pneumonia on the chest X-ray, they have new respiratory symptoms, so cough, congestion, maybe some hypoxia, but they have no fever, no leukocytosis, and generally pretty stable otherwise. So the procalcitonin added into that picture can help us feel a little more secure with not starting antibiotics. it's a situation we should probably not start antibiotics anyway, but I think in an older, frail population, it's nice to have some, you know, reassuring measures such as procalcitonin. It's an inexpensive test, costs $25. It can be added to your initial workup with a CBC and a chest x-ray. And, you know, the levels below about 0.25 is kind of a general cutoff to use when determining not to use antibiotics. You know, the other point with procalcitonin, really with any specific lab value, is none of that trumps good clinical judgment. So all of our care should be individualized. We should take into consideration the comorbidities and the frail population that we work with. So I have a few other things I'm going to summarize real quick from the COPD study I did, as well as the reviews that I've been doing on antibiotics. So it's important to remind patients that smoking cessation still has the greatest capacity to influence the course of someone's COPD. Spirometry is required to make the diagnosis of COPD. If it hasn't been done, then it really needs to be, as it can very much guide treatments and recommendations. Clinical trials have shown a greater effect on lowering exacerbation rates for COPD with LAMAs, long-acting muscarinic antagonists, over LABAs, the long-acting beta agonists. Several gold guidelines to help guide treatments are out there, but generally speaking, it's short-acting bronchodilators for rescue therapy, LAMAs first for maintenance, then LABAs, then potentially adding inhaled corticosteroids. However, the combination of a LAMA and a LABA is shown to be more effective than being on one or increasing the dose of one. And so what about inhaled corticosteroids? So, you know, the COPD inflammation really has less responsiveness in general to inhaled corticosteroids. Inhaled corticosteroids can be helpful to reduce frequency of exacerbations and improve the quality of life, but only if their FEV1 is less than 60% predicted. Inhaled corticosteroids associated with an increased risk of pneumonia, and recent data suggests that a LAMA-LABA combo has less adverse events than the LAMA-LABA inhaled corticosteroid combo. And then finally, per the one of the articles that I reviewed, eosinophils can be used as a biomarker to help determine if inhaled corticosteroids or oral steroids is good for the patient. Recent data suggests that inhaled corticosteroids are not effective in patients with eosinophil counts less than 100 and have the most benefit in counts that are over 300. So again, part of a good thorough workup, and you know, as our population, and we're trying to tease out sort of the end stage COPD patients that could benefit from either oral or inhaled corticosteroids. Finally, I'm going to briefly talk about azithromycin. So, in doing the antibiotic reviews, I have noted everything from, you know, people just starting azithromycin on all patients with COPD after the GOLD guidelines came out, to just really an overall increased use because the GOLD guidelines do talk about some of the benefits. There's definitely benefits. There's definitely some evidence. However, the azithromycin at 250 milligrams a day or 500 milligrams three times per week in patients who are having frequent exacerbations or hospitalizations has been shown to reduce these events. So my interpretation of the GOLD guidelines and the data is that you need to remember that azithromycin is also associated with increased risk in bacterial resistance and some evidence of worsening hearing. It's less beneficial in active smokers, and there's no data beyond a year of treatment showing either the efficacy or safety concerns. So I consider reserving this treatment to end-stage COPD patients who keep having repeat exacerbations. Maybe they're going to the hospital, but they're requiring, you know, increasing treatments on, let's say, a monthly or regular basis. And then I try to limit it also to people who have also quit smoking. That ends up being a pretty limited population that I think probably benefit from the use of a chronic azithromycin. And evidence suggests that 250 milligrams or the three times a week, 500 milligrams, can be just as good, and that reduces pill burden a little bit. So that's kind of how we've interpreted the GOLD guidelines. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Eric Yeager, who is the Chief of Pulmonary of Critical Care for VIVAGE.
I am going to include and send out to you an article called Prophylactic Antibiotic Use in COPD and the Potential Anti-Inflammatory Activities. So first, let me talk about the antibiotic use for antibiotics in COPD for their antimicrobial effect, and then we'll get into what everybody hates, which is biochemistry and talking about the anti-inflammatory use. There's a big two-pooled study that took place, and they looked at seven studies. The best one was 483 participants in a meta-analysis. They always are, and they looked at treatment failure, which was death, no resolution or deterioration, adverse effects, and importantly, time to the next COPD exacerbation. And one trial, 310 patients who were ambulatory were having a COPD exacerbation, and they either received a placebo or Augmentin for 8 days. And surprisingly, antibiotic therapy decreased treatment failure, 27% versus 42%. So a lot of people got better faster. The effect was driven by lack of resolution and deterioration. There were no deaths. The most important thing I found was that the time to the next exacerbation was decreased by 73 days. Pretty significant benefit to antibiotics to reduce the treatment failure and increase the time between COPD exacerbations. As you already heard, there are problems with using antibiotics. Most of the adverse effects were GI effects. People get gastrointestinal upset even if they don't get C. diff. So you have to keep that in mind when you're using this to treat an antibiotic. So a lot of studies actually show that treating people with high enough suspicion for infection makes a difference. In 2010, Healthcare Excellence advised that antibiotics should be used to treat exacerbations of COPD associated with purulent sputum. I think in most of our COPDers, we can make the argument that they have purulent sputum. So a lot of this is clinical judgment, and antibiotic selection should be based on local sensitivity patterns always. So it doesn't make sense to treat someone with a broad spectrum like a quinolone if your quinolones in your area are very poor. So those are the take-home message for antibiotic uses. Criteria in older studies suggested that continued use of antibiotics in people with COPD wasn't good. More recent studies show that regular use may reduce exacerbation rate. So that's the real take. And it didn't really make a difference if you used, if you were treating people chronically for COPD, like azithromycin 250 a day or 500 milligrams three times per week, the reduction in exacerbations was the same. But I think that when you're doing chronic therapy, it has a different effect, and that's what we're going to get into. Chronic therapy, I don't think the old thinking was decrease the bacterial load and decrease the exacerbations. I think what we found is that chronic therapy with antibiotics really work as an anti-inflammatory. Antibiotics previously showed anti-inflammatory properties dating back to when people used to use erythromycin on a regular basis, and they found that it would decrease the number of COPD exacerbations. 12 trials with about 4,000 participants were looked at in the study that I provided for you. Actually, it's not one study, it's a number of studies that are quoted. But the antibiotics used were azithromycin, clarithromycin, erythromycin, roxithromycin, which I've never used, I think it's a European drug, and moxifloxacin. Azithromycin and erythromycin showed the greatest effect in subjects with COPD, with evidence suggesting improvement in exacerbation-related outcomes and health status, and an increase in antibiotic resistance was reported in two of the studies. So a macrolide class of antibiotics are probably the best for doing this anti-inflammatory type process. We've already talked about the GOLD criteria. This is typically used in your more severe COPDers. So the question is, do antibiotics have a positive therapeutic effect in patients with stable COPD? So if they're stable, they're a total of 12 randomized controls, again with about 3,500 studies subjects were included in this study I looked at, and azithromycin was the main one used, and they used it in different ways, the continuous, the intermittent. One study even used 500 milligrams for 3 days a month, but that one wasn't very successful. So we'll talk about the ones with the more typical. The main study included 1,000 participants, and basically the primary outcome was the time to first exacerbation, and the results showed a significant improvement for the azithromycin treatment group. So it was 266 days compared to 174 days with a p-value of 0.001. So this showed a large statistical favoring of using azithromycin in patients with severe COPD on a continuous basis. Three studies evaluated erythromycin, which was somewhat less effective, but still very effective, and was promising a continuous low dose for a different reason, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But the other antibiotics weren't studied as well, but clarithromycin and doxycycline, so no effect as prophylactic therapy. So when you're using doxycycline, we used to do that on a regular basis to decrease bacterial load. It didn't have any anti-inflammatory effect. Okay, so is the effect we're talking about potentially anti-inflammatory in nature? Well, realize, as we were just saying before, corticosteroids are used to target inflammation. That's usually how we've done it. But interestingly, corticosteroids are not very good in the chronic inflammation in COPD. And inhaled corticosteroids are especially not very good in acute inflammation because they can actually make it worse. So there's a couple of thoughts of what's going on. The corticosteroids target general inflammation, but they have only a modest effect on airway inflammation and COPD, probably due to reduced histone deacetylase, I always pronounce that correctly, activity in COPD. So the macrolides and other classes have attracted attention because they actually improve the HDAC or histone deacetylase concentration in a body. Neutrophils and macrophages are also important. If you think back to your basic biochemistry and molecular biology, they're basically constant release of pro-inflammatory cytokines from macrophages and neutrophils leads to a perpetual state of chronic inflammation. That's where the COPD chronic inflammation comes from. So a study by Hodge and others, which I'll send you, showed that ineffective clearance of the breakdown products of bronchial epithelial cells by their macrophages increase inflammation as the necrotic material is removed. So when you use low-dose azithromycin, you can improve the phagocytic function of the macrophages, and that actually, we have plenty of studies that show that. There's also a thing called a mannose receptor, which has been shown to be underexpressed in COPD, and once again, azithromycin improves the mannose receptor effectiveness. So it's another important thing to realize. So the take-home message is that azithromycin, especially erythromycin, somewhat improve these all of these functions of macrophages and phagocytes that help decrease inflammation. So the big downside of keeping people on azithromycin long term is that you get side effects. You have hearing loss, you have macrolide resistance. So interestingly, and it's not out yet, but there is a experimental drug called CSY0073, which significantly decreases neutrophil. It's a non-antibiotic azithromycin, and it significantly reduces neutrophil count. It, in this case, was by 23%. Unfortunately, azithromycin did it by 63%. So it's not as effective, but they're working on it. So we may eventually hypothesize that within a few years, we will have a drug that's not an antibiotic, but has the same anti-inflammatory effects. There's also transcriptional factors. There are There's a nuclear factor kappa chain enhancer B cell, NFKB, or NFKB beta, which induces numerous pro-inflammatory processes. That comes from mostly cigarette smoking, and that's why we get problems with COPD. And specifically in that case, erythromycin has been shown to reduce the activity in those monocytes treated with cigarette smoke active extract. So when you take mice and you expose them to cigarette smoke extract and you give them erythromycin, they do significantly better. So erythromycin has one benefit there. So I think, and then the other is that the macrolides also inhibit pro-inflammatory interleukins, so IL-1, IL-6, IL-10, goes on and on, but so it crosses the whole spectrum of anti-inflammatory activity. So in summary, I'm sending you a review that indicates that prophylactic use of low-dose macrolide antibiotics is in benefit in reducing exacerbation-related outcomes in COPD, including frequency of exacerbations, duration of the exacerbation, and time until the next exacerbation after starting therapy. It only applies to azithromycin and erythromycin, and the other antibiotics had no clinically important improvement. So if you have people that are having exacerbations and you're treating them with multiple courses of oral corticosteroids, then I would recommend that you do one of these courses. I prefer the 500 milligrams three times a week, but there's no benefit to that. And those are the people. Are you pretty much in agreement? That's mm-hmm. who you're treating?
Yeah.
And you know, and then obviously there's a crossover that we always talk about between with COPD patients with bronchitis and bronchiectatic patients, and some of those people we used to treat for their change of purulent sputum, but I've not seen any recent data that say that's an appropriate use. So I think we're over-treating the people that we call bronchiectatic, and we may be under-treating the patients with exacerbations, especially in our facilities, because it's an antibiotic. So I think if you write the reason we're doing it for a very pro anti-inflammatory response, if it also serves to get people off chronic oral or intravenous corticosteroids, then I think it's a benefit too. It probably shouldn't replace inhaled corticosteroids.
I have a quick question. So the use of eosinophils to help identify an inflammatory component, would that apply to the use of azithromycin at all? If those values, I don't know that I saw any studies to indicate that. But.
Well, the eosinophils were always more of an atopic type of thing. We used to do them with bronchial alveolar lavage for years. I don't think there's enough data, but I think it's certainly one more thing you can add to it. I don't think it's as strong saying that it's eosinophilia tells you to use anti-inflammatories, but people are, we certainly look at it in asthma. I don't know that I'm an expert on eosinophils and COPD. I think that's one of the first articles that we've seen that for. For asthma now, we're using more biologics now too, and we're using eosinophils to guide that. So I think it's probably coming, but I don't think I've seen enough data for it.
Dr. Yeager, great presentation. Travis, great presentation. Not infrequently receive patients back from the hospital, back from the ER, who have pneumonia on steroids, on systemic corticosteroids. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, we should be careful using these medic types of anti-inflammatory medications because they could worsen, they could increase the risk for sepsis, they have minimal effect, et cetera, et cetera. So what do we do after the ER doc has started our patients on a 40 milligrams of prednisone? Do we just stop it?
I think we do a rapid taper. I think what happens is we get so intimidated. The patients, part of the problem is there's no definitive data on how long you taper for. Acute exacerbations are different in treating them than they are for avoiding exacerbations. Corticosteroids don't really have a place in that, although I've got patients I'm still working to get off of long-term corticosteroids oral because they believe that it makes a huge difference. Corticosteroids have a lot of other effects that make you feel good. And so I can't, psychologically, people become bound to them, so I try to get them off as quickly as possible. It's great for that first few days when they're having an exacerbation. I have a patient in the hospital who is having an exacerbation. First thing I'm gonna do is I start solumedrol, then I quickly switch them over to prednisone, and I try to get them off within a week. But if they send them out and their feeling is, I felt so much better, don't take me off of them, that's where it becomes a problem when we can't. It's same as any medications patients come to like. COPDers come to like prednisone. And we've got to convince them that prednisone is not a helpful thing for them in the long term. For one, it doesn't do anything for the chronic inflammation. And for two, it has so many side effects. So, and we've said, inhaled corticosteroids are marginal benefit in COPD over the long term, or parts of COPD. We still should use it, but I think we ought to augment it with the other anti-inflammatory properties. There are so many inflammatory agents. Steroids aren't great at getting all of them. It's a generalized. It's basically killing a fly with a bazooka. And we're often over-treating, and then we end up with side effects. We don't treat the basic problem.
If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.